The Guardian.
Football Weekly Extra.
Today, League Cup, call it the Bantam Menace, as Bradford's semi-development puts Villa in the shade and Bantams into a historic battle of fairy tales, David versus also David, dream League Cup finale. Shock meanwhile at Swansea-Chelsea, as Eden Hazard kicks a kid for wasting Chelsea's time, and Fernando Torres seen going into hiding. More cup drama on the way this weekend in the FA Cup fifth round and the Africa Cup of Nations. Who lit up matches in the can this week? Apart from Jason Puncheon in his cheeky mid-game toilet break against Everton. All of those questions and more in today's Football Weekly Extra. Hi, everybody. You join us just as Barry's getting abreast of what was the quirky football story of the week until last night's action down at the Liberty Stadium. Yes, it was Monday night, Southampton against Everton. And Jacob, can you take up the story?
It was second half of the Southampton-Everton game, and suddenly Southampton were down to 10 men, despite not having a player sent off. Jason Puncheon nature called.
I was unaware of this.
Yeah. Right, yeah. Right. Yeah.
So, what, it was about 10 minutes he was off, wasn't it?
It was a sustained period, yeah.
Did he have a nice book with him?
I don't know. He was looking for Nigel Atkins in it.
There was no explanation. Anyway, he received some kind of ribbing, if you will, from the crowd and smiled ruefully.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, cool. Mm. And Southampton kept a clean sheet, but I'm going to move on at this point. Nice to see you, Jacob.
Hello.
Nice Raphael Honigstein, hi.
Hello.
And Barry Glendinning.
Hello.
Hello to you. Well, Bradford City, what a story.
Yeah, it's a marvellous story. And at a time when, you know, people get very angry about football and there's lots of bad news and horrible headlines about this and that, the Bantams have made it through to the final. And I think everyone will want them to win it. Apart from Swansea fans, of course.
That's true.
They get the highest attendance in League Two, so about 10,500 average gate last season, which is remarkable for a fourth-tier team. And 10 years ago, they were on the brink of going out of business. They went there; their owner went bankrupt, and I think they had debts of $24 million or something. So the money they will win, or the net as from TV and prize money and whatnot, will be welcome.
Absolutely. Mark Lawn, chairman, says this lets people not just in England but all around the country who are down in the dumps with the recession show that underdogs can come through and that dreams can happen.
Yeah, it's brilliant. But, I mean, Swansea is almost as good a story, really. Ten years ago, they were going out of business. And
bottom place in the league structure.
And they've turned it around without any real sort of investment. They've just put themselves up as a wonderfully run club. It's quite interesting. I think when they signed Laudrup, I think they told him, you know, we want you to coach the team. We don't need you to run the club. We can do that ourselves. And I think it strikes a blow for that kind of structure in many ways.
Mm. What do you think Bradford's chances are, given the number of Premier League teams they've already beaten on their way, over two legs in this case, what do you think their chances are against Swansea?
I would personally still favour Swansea. I think they're a much better side. I think they caught Arsenal off guard, and Villa probably can't even be seen as a Premier League side at the moment. Swansea are a much better team. Over one game, they should really do it, but it's not impossible, of course.
What do you think, Jacob?
I probably agree with Rafa, especially on, you know, the way that Swansea play, the passing style, keeping the ball, and Wembley's such a big pitch. You know, you might think that they could exploit that kind of space and go along with the fact, although they've beaten three Premier League sides against Arsenal, it was a great achievement, but Arsenal were caught off guard, as Rafa says, and again, Villa were appalling in that second half on Tuesday night.
Mm. Yeah. All right. Great headline on Wednesday morning after James Hansen got the crucial away goal. Jim Hansen and the Muppets. Aston Villa conceding four goals over two legs to a Bradford team that's only scored three times in their last four League Two fixtures. Aye, aye, aye.
Yeah, Paul Lambert looked genuinely shell-shocked after the game. I think he honestly thought Villa would overturn the deficit and go through to the final. And Villa are in a lot of trouble now. We were saying on Monday that, you know, they would be a sore loss to the Premier League, that Lambert seems to be trying to build something good there with some very young players. But this is just going to be another huge dent to their confidence.
And those very young players now face a trip this weekend to the Den to take on Millwall. That'd be fun, the FA Cup.
And to be honest, Millwall would be rubbing their hands together with glee at the prospect, because there's every chance they'll beat Villa.
All right. Lualtam says, what are the odds now anyway on Michael Laudrup becoming Chelsea boss next year?
There's a bit of reported interest in Laudrup for Chelsea. Don't know how far that goes, because you know at Chelsea you always have to take it with a pinch of salt based on whether Abramovich actually wants him. You know, it's still,
his brother did time there, didn't he?
Yeah, Brian Laudrup. He had about 3 months at Chelsea in '98, but you know, it's still 6 months, and is the Chelsea job that great a job to be taking out at the moment?
Well, yeah,
I suppose it depending on how focused you are on just boosting your bank balance. Mm-hmm. But would Laudrup want the Chelsea job? Would any sane manager want the Chelsea
piece
job?
Yesterday, where he was saying, comparing himself to Pep Guardiola, saying how old he looked after four years of being at Barcelona.
And Laudrup was saying this,
yeah, to Pep, and he's saying he quite likes the sort of more relaxed life. There's not a lot of pressure at Swansea, and you know, you can just get on with it. And
interesting, because Michuk's extending his contract down there this week and saying he's living the dream.
Yeah,
well, at the
Wembley final, going to get into Europe, maybe.
Absolutely, or maybe Bradford will. Wouldn't that be amazing?
It would be amazing. Be truly amazing to see them in the Europa League. But Laudrup is an interesting one, because he really came to the Premier League, I think, with a point to prove after not being completely convincing in Spain, and the way he's played with Swansea and the way they've reached a League Cup final and doing really well in the league. It's almost as if he's made the second step after what Brendan Rodgers did the year before. Mm. They even seem to be playing better. And, of course, signing Mitchell was an absolute masterstroke. So I wouldn't be surprised if there's a lot of interest coming in for him, because he is very suave. He's urbane. He speaks a lot of languages. And he's shown himself to be very adaptable.
Right.
Bit like yourself.
There's a lot of work for people like that, isn't there, Rafa? he couldn't do it with Getafe, but he can do it with the Taffies, in a very real sense. Nice.
I was looking, actually, the prize money for the Capital One Cup is
a lot of money.
No, it's not.
It is a lot of money.
It's £100,000.
£100,000,
well,
for the winner.
Why are they talking about a million and they've already earned £1.3 million?
That's gate receipts and TV money.
That's where the money is, isn't it?
But the actual prize money is just £100,000. For the winner, 50 grand for the runners-up, 25 grand each for the losing semi-finalists, and that's
So that's a little bit of a bonus.
You could nearly sponsor it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think so.
Plus a free balance transfer.
Yeah. No, tell you what we haven't mentioned. The ball boy affair. Ball man affair.
Ball adult.
Ball adult.
It was hilarious. I think the only way it could feasibly have been funnier is if Luis Suarez had done it, and, you know,
there would have been.
You know, you can't really be kicking ball boys, even if they are 17 years old.
Right.
Only 5 years younger than you, indeed, and lying on the ball, preventing you from getting it back into play. But, yeah, it was hilarious. And, as usual, some people have taken it far too seriously, and one numpty has even reported it to the police.
Really?
Meaning they have to now investigate it.
Is it Peter Herbert?
Who's Peter Herbert?
The Society of Black Lawyers.
Ah! Even he.
The whole thing reminded me a little bit of the discussion in Clark's when they talk about the subcontractors on the Death Star. That ball boy was wearing studs, and you think, you know, he knows what he's letting himself in for, you know.
Right.
He can only blame himself.
Yeah, he wanted to get involved, and he did
so
get involved.
So he got kicked, but it is funny because, you know, professional footballers, especially at this level, are paid to hit very small object with incredible accuracy, but whenever they kick people, we always hear that it's accidental, they're clumsy, they didn't know what they were doing, they missed, which, you know, is hard to believe.
Right. Well,
the ball boy had mentioned on his Twitter account earlier in the day that he was coming out of retirement for basically one match only, and then dubbed himself sort of king of the time wasters.
Yep.
So,
whereas we all know where that title lies. Anyway, they both shouldn't have done it, but it was quite interesting.
I think the world is a better place for it having happened, and I hope that Eden Hazard doesn't get punished too heavily for it.
There's a lot of talk of lengthy bans because he might have pushed him a bit. To begin with. Anyway, well, Free the Hazard 1. That's very much our message.
And pray for the ball boy.
And pray for the ball boy. Man. Also in Wednesday night football news, how about that Arsenal-West Ham game? Now, I bet you weren't able to see this, were you, Jacob?
I was there.
Oh, crikey. Were you actually there at the Emirates?
Yeah.
You were one of the happy few.
Why?
Because there weren't many people at the Emirates.
I think he was one of the unhappy few.
Oh, you were one of the unhappy few, yeah.
Fair point. There were a lot of empty seats, actually, right. But they said there were 60,000 tickets
potential sold.
Yeah. So it was a strange game, actually, because West Ham played quite well in the first half and probably could have been ahead by half time. They had Arsenal were very, very dodgy defending set pieces, as you know they usually are, and Sam Allardyce's side good at attacking the set pieces. And they had a couple of chances. They scored a very good goal. Podolski equalised with an absolute screamer. It was superb. Nothing you could really do about that. And then Arsenal sort of came back into it, and Carlton Cole had a shot cleared off the line just before half-time. So you're thinking, OK, this is going OK, this is all right. Arsenal came out and were absolutely brilliant for 10 or 15 minutes in the second half, and they destroyed West Ham down the left flank. Podolski was just brilliant, really, really good. So I think he scored one in the first half and set up maybe three goals. I lost count by the end.
Right.
It was just so absurd. I was just kind of laughing when the fifth goal went in because Arsenal was so good.
Right, 5-1. Andrew Thomas tweeting, everybody duck, the Arsenal pendulum's coming back the other way again. But these 12 brilliant minutes, what does it mean? Is this the real Arsenal? I'm very, very confused now.
The thing is, the real Arsenal have a tendency to better very poor position at home. Like Southampton, like Newcastle, they have a tendency to draw against medium opposition, and they cannot be any top opposition.
Right.
So there is actually a consistency in that sort of inconsistent pattern. And the thing was, they were brilliant over the first 10 minutes or so of the second half, but the defending from West Ham, or the positioning, shall we say, was just all over the place. I could not believe what was going on there. They were basically starting to push up all the way into Arsenal's half. And of course, somebody like Podolski with a bit of space on the flanks is a very different player. The reason why he hasn't been 100% convincing at Arsenal is because he usually comes up against teams who sit very deep. He can't really take anyone on 1v1. He doesn't have a lot of pace. But if you give him space, and if you can effectively make Arsenal a counter-attacking side, they're very, very good. But I just think West Ham were absolutely shocking. Whether by design or by accident, what they did in the second half, I just didn't understand.
At half time, I was with my uncle, who's an Arsenal fan. He was saying to me, "I don't understand why you're not being more adventurous. You know, Arsenal are there to be attacked." And I said, "No, because you can't leave yourself open against Arsenal because you'll get killed on the counter attack. Yeah. We're doing it absolutely perfectly." And then they did what he said they should do, and they lost. They lost 5-1. But I think they missed Jimmy Collins, actually. Tompkins at the back, they're a bit dodgy when he's playing. He hasn't played very well this season, and although Collins makes a few errors here and there, the organisation wasn't there, and Demel right back was just killed by Podolski.
Anyway, Arsenal playing with Zip again, a bit like their manager on the sideline, his coat, and they're taking on Brighton, the team that knocked out Newcastle, at the Amex Stadium. Hey, strong potential for upset, or does this conform to your Arsenal beating lesser opposition in big fashion paradigm?
We'll see.
All right, we will. It's Arsenal's only shot at a trophy, Barry.
They're not interested in trophies.
Hold on, they're still in the Champions League.
Oh, yeah. It's Arsenal's only shot at a trophy.
Yeah, I'd agree with you there. But I don't think the Arsenal hierarchy are interested in winning trophies. They're interested in accumulating as much money as they can.
It was quite interesting. Last night they were all saying that they've already been getting emails about their season tickets to renew for next season.
Really?
Yeah. And they're all wondering, you know, are they saying this now before we know where we end up? Basically.
Right. Yeah. Now, Arsenal Champions League means Bayern Munich, Rafa, and perhaps in a moment or two you might tell us a little bit more about them now that they've got their Bundesliga campaign back underway.
This week on The Guardian Audio Edition. Algeria hostage crisis over after further casualties. Spies, Chopin and a last-minute rescue in Libya. And our audiobook review is a crime special looking at Raymond Chandler's greatest stories and a new audiobook from Stuart Neville, Ratlines. To subscribe for free, go to audible.co.uk/Guardian Audio. or find us on SoundCloud and iTunes. The Guardian Audio Edition, a new way to get the whole picture.
Hey, listeners, the good news is Rafa has consented to tell us all about the Bundesliga, which is back underway after the extended winter break. Bayern Munich, what did they do?
They won 2-0 against Greuther Fürth, but the game was completely overshadowed by the Pep hype.
Oh, right, okay.
And everyone asking everyone, what do you think about Pep coming? Even the Greuther Fürth players were asked after the game. They all sort of shrugged their shoulders and said, what do you want me to say? And Jupp Heynckes, the manager, got a little bit of a hump because he said, you know, I'm actually still here managing now and I'm in charge and I've had enough of this. And that is also the background of why Bayern were very unhappy that the story broke so early. They wanted to keep it on the wraps a lot longer.
Mm. Interesting. How did it come out? I mean, the Italians got hold of it because he left a meeting that he was going to have with AC Milan.
I'm not sure it was that. What my understanding is that one of the agents involved is an Italian, and he has a friend in the media.
Oh, okay.
Who broke the story.
All right, then.
Sky Italia.
Now, there's been some suggestion that Luis Suarez might be Pep's first big signing.
Well, there's a story doing the rounds that Pep has sort of one buy that he can bring in. And there's talk of Neymar, because he's apparently talked to him. There's talk of Suarez, talk of Cavani.
Right.
Falcao even being mentioned, which is very interesting. It kind of makes sense because Bayern changing to a system where they're buying a lot of young players. Mm-hmm. They signed this Mainz defender.
Is he a sweeper?
What? He's not a sweeper.
Okay.
He's a centre-back who can also play in centre midfield. There's talk of them buying another sort of young, talented German player. And, of course, they're bringing through players from their own system. What that means is that frees up funds to buy one big player a year. So I think they're switching to a system where instead of buying sort of three or four decent players, they might actually concentrate on one superstar every year. And, of course, those names would fit into that that new strategy. So it would be very, very interesting if Pep can pull it off.
Do you see Arsenal with any chance against Bayern Munich?
Of course they've got a chance. I mean, Bayern a little bit shaky at the back. Not so much in the league where they've only conceded, I think, six or seven. But in the Champions League, they haven't looked that convincing. At the back, they've also got a problem with Jerome Boateng being suspended. So Daniel van Beuten might have to play it at the back. Holger Badstuber is injured. So they have, you know, they have one or two weaknesses. Going forward, they should get some joy against this Arsenal team. But I wouldn't rule them out completely. I think they've got a chance, Gunners. But the other interesting thing is, or the other big news in German football is that Hannover have signed a Brazilian player. He was supposed to be 1.90 meters, and he came in, and Mirko Slomka, the manager, was talking to him and found himself looking down on him, thinking, oh, hold on a second, you are supposed to be taller than me. So they got the measure tape out and found he was 6 centimeters shorter than advised.
Really?
Yeah. They got the measure tape out and found that he was 6 centimeters shorter than advertised.
Wow.
So they now put a blanket ban on video transfers, because apparently they'd only seen on DVD, which really should have been enforced before, because you don't really sign players.
People always look bigger on TV.
Exactly.
Yeah. Wow.
And wider. So that's a funny.
That is funny. But 1.90 meters, that would be too tall, though, wouldn't it? It's probably good news that he's 6 centimeters smaller.
I don't know.
All right. There's also been Schein returning to Dortmund.
Yeah.
Left for 12 million, came back on a free. That's good business.
Well, he's on loan at the moment,
right? Okay.
So that would be free.
Yeah.
And we don't know if there's any loan sort of charge involved. And they have a right to buy him back from Real Madrid after 18 months. It's interesting because he left and now he's come back and there's by no means a guarantee that he'll actually start to get regular game time. But what he does do is really increase their options in midfield. They've been struggling a little bit when it comes to sort of depth and rotation. They've got very, very good first 11. Then the quality drops quite significantly. Now that he's there, they can rotate a little bit, which will help them, or should help them, to go deep in all the competitions. Because, of course, as you know, they've got Shakhtar Donetsk in the next round, which is going to be a tough one. And they've got Bayern away in the quarterfinal of the German Cup.
Right.
So it's going to be a very interesting couple of weeks coming up for them.
All right. Schalke, in the meantime, this Luis Holtby fellow, has he, as has been suggested, played his last game for them?
Well, knowing Daniel Levy, he will wait until the 31st of January to sort of put his last offer down. So there is a chance he'll play again this weekend, because they will, of course, keep playing him unless that deal gets agreed. They've apparently asked for £2 million, which Spurs have completely balked at and saying, well, how dare you ask for so much money? We're not going to pay that. So it's really just about valuation. They've made an offer which was sort of considered derisory. Schalke said this is the price, take it or leave it, because of course they have already bought him for the summer.
Right.
So if they want him now, it's £2 million.
Okay.
But we'll have to wait to see.
And he would slot in what, behind Defoe or behind whoever the striker is, or how would that work?
His best position is a number 10, sort of in the Van der Vaart mold, with a fairly free role. He can play a bit deeper. He played a little bit deeper for Schalke this season, and also in the 5-4 win against Hannover.
Right.
But I think a little bit like Modric, you can't really see him sort of playing as one of the two central midfielders right now. Maybe he grows into that role, maybe he comes a bit more physical, but he's a very technical player, and I think they'll have to sort of put him up a bit further up where there's less 50-50s and high balls sort of flying in.
All right. Anything else about the Bundesliga? Or should we talk about Newcastle and their French spending spree? How about that, eh? 101 great goals, pointing out French players on Newcastle books at the start of the week: Debussy, Kabaye, Ben Arfa, Amafitana, Sylvain Marveau and Aubertin. And then they added to them Yanga and Biwa, and then Haidara. Sorry about my pronunciation there. Don't know if anyone's got an update on that. How you said no? Okay. And then you could also be added, I think Young Gouffran has now also joined, is that right? And Moussa Sissoko. So he could end up with 10 outfield players from France alone.
Yeah, I mean, the jokes are doing the rounds.
Yeah. What are the jokes? Let's hear them, Barry.
Well, Newcastle have been rechristened New Chateau.
Oh,
and they're managed by Alan Pardew. and he's getting some stick for comments he made several years ago about the importance of British input or English input in a Premier League side.
I think top sides should not lose focus of the fact that this is the English Premier League and it should be an English core to the team.
When he was at West Ham.
Yeah.
And then they were rubbish, so maybe he's there.
He's moved on. Yeah. Well, you know, everyone's...
Well, we don't know either
how much input he has.
Input, yeah, exactly. Yeah. He has into the signings.
Yeah, so. That's true.
But in all seriousness, I think he's got a point, and I think that's something that might be relevant for Chelsea as well. I think you do need sort of indigenous input at some level to keep a team going. They might not have to be sort of English in a true sense. They could have been youngsters that have come through the system, a little bit like Fabregas at Arsenal. But I think if you just end up playing with 11, 13 players who, you know, just come from somewhere else, I think there's always a problem.
Right.
In the
Arsenal have actually gone the opposite way, haven't they, with tying down all these five or six.
Because I think Wenger's realised that if he wants to build something and not keep rebuilding a squad every 2 or 3 years because the better players leave, the way to do it is to keep young English players and make them sort of feel that they are part of the Arsenal identity, which I think is going to be very difficult for a club like Newcastle. When it works, it's great, but when it doesn't, we've seen a couple of years ago, I think, we're in a fairly similar situation with very good players, but absolutely no coherence and no real sort of spirit in the dressing room.
Mm.
Will those... that cabal of French players at Newcastle, will they like sort of form their own dressing room clique or 10 individual cliques, man clique, you know, with the French dressing room discord,
right,
sort of famous throughout the football world?
I don't know, Barry, but it's a legitimate concern that you raise for a club.
And of course, there's also the fact Newcastle are pretty desperate now, so they can't really afford to be that picky about who they sign.
Well, that's true. A lot of comment in France about the notion of all these players leaving top French sides for a team very much at the bottom end of the Premier League. And you can hear some of those views in a very special paper review up at The Guardian's website this Friday morning. In other transfer news, well, you've got your Wilfried Zaha to Man United. Has that gone through now?
I don't think so.
Did you do rumour mill this morning, Barry?
I did, and there was. I think they were hoping to do the deal today. So I suppose the question is, will he be loaned back to Crystal Palace for the rest of the season?
Right.
Or was last weekend in the snow his last game for Crystal Palace? And I don't know the answer to that question.
No, okay.
You're looking at me quizzically.
No, I don't have the answer to this question either. Anthony Venditozzi says, do you have any good information on whether reports Drogba might go to Milan are accurate? Because, of course, Didier had been very much associated with Juventus. Suggestions were that they were both, there was a little bit of brinksmanship on both sides. But now up pop Milan, supposedly with some actual money to throw at Didier. Well, all very interesting. But it certainly seems to be an option, Drogba and Balotelli, because the price on Balotelli is dropping. Dropping
by the minute. Mm. But a genuine question, what is the Italian fascination with players that are very old and not worth the money anymore? Like Kaká, they wanted Milan want Kaká back because, you know, he's been so good.
Well, and I think the first obvious point is that Serie A is a league, an environment in which an older player can still flourish. And as such, they're able to pick up bargains of players who are not considered good enough.
They're
for,
not bargains,
well,
these players.
I think they generally, teams like Milan will try and get them when they are bargains. They might feel Kaká, they'll and there again, there's a little bit of brinksmanship going on with Real Madrid. Kaká apparently has massively reduced his wage demands, and now it's just a case of how much Real are going to ask for to let him go. And they feel that while he won't have an impact anymore, isn't capable of doing the same things that Real would want him to do, for Milan he would be more than good enough, especially when you look at the quality of their side. It'd be interesting if he does go. I mean, I'd love to see him go back there. And Balotelli, well, that's just because he's kind of considered toxic, I guess. But yeah, there was even talk of Beckham and his people being in talk. That really is a mind-boggling thought. But hey, let's look at some other posts. Wilson Bowie says, I have a tech question. Last week, mention was made of AC Jimbo having an iPad mini. Does it look like a normal iPad when he holds it? Simplicicans talking about Robin van Persie, says it's getting dull, talking about all that. United have actually scored only one goal more than they did without him after 23 games last season. It's interesting. And finally, post-wise, Mr. Gareth E says, Joitex Frimpong is my fun name to say. He's a Ghana striker playing in Switzerland. He probably don't say it that way, but that's how I would. Right, that's enough for part two. Next up, Jonathan Wilson, we hope, at the Africa Cup of Nations. Oh, I like that. Bit of Atmos. Hey, everybody, we're live, and that was the Zambia squad going to lunch, Jonathan. You're with the Zambian national team. Where, in a restaurant?
I'm in a hotel. We're doing a press conference here in about an hour. So,
right.
I'm sitting by the pool, about to have a club sandwich myself, and I'm doing some work.
All right.
And then I just went by, and then I just saw Kennedy Mwina, and suddenly, well, they're playing the collab I can see now with his funny hair.
Right.
And, yeah, they're all just filing into the restaurant.
Are you wearing linen?
I'm not. I'm wearing a cotton polo shirt and predictable African cotton trousers.
Oh, sensible. Are they a nice bunch, the Zambians, despite their disappointments early in this cup?
Well, they certainly were last year. I haven't really talked to any of them yet this time round. I just arrived in Nelspruit last night, just went to do the Nigeria press conference, met Steve Kashi again, which is always good. He's always good value, a Nigeria coach. He was reminding everybody that you can't build a house in a day. Seems a bit less ambitious than building Rome in a day, but, you know.
I think you can.
But, yeah, just come to the Zambian Hotel and, yeah, I'll be speaking to them in 45 minutes, an hour or so.
Right. What else have you been up to, Jonathan?
Been doing a lot of travelling. Was in Johannesburg on Saturday for the opening games, and then to Port Elizabeth on Sunday for the Ghana, the Congo game, and, yeah, that group. Then I went back to Johannesburg, and I was in Rustenburg for day before yesterday, is that right? Yeah. For Ivory Coast, they're starting against Togo. So, yeah, I've done six games so far, three double headers.
Jonathan, you were at the World Cup in 2010. What's happened in the meantime? Do you feel that something has changed, the country's moved on, it's benefited in some ways, or is it all just...
I don't know. It's really difficult to tell. I mean, it's the obvious... Yeah, the obvious thing to look at here is sort of when you're looking at kind of a bigger picture and a kind of big wrap-up piece at the end of the tournament. So I've been talking to a whole number of people about it. And, you know, just in terms of infrastructure, the fact that the big road between Pretoria and Johannesburg is now four lanes in each carriageway, not two. That was done for the World Cup. That's an immediate big thing. I know that sounds almost trivial, but car ownership has shot up in South Africa in the last 10 years as sort of the middle class gets bigger. So that was desperately needed because that road just got snarled up all the time. The GO train is now working, which was meant to be open for the World Cup and wasn't, but I was on that yesterday, and that's incredibly swift and efficient and good. So from an infrastructure point of view, definitely things have improved. The stadiums obviously are still here, and you know, without those stadiums, South Africa wouldn't be hosting the tournament. But they, you know, because they held the World Cup, they could step in when the conflict happened in Libya, and Libya couldn't host it. It should have been in Libya. So the fact they're here, the fact that South Africa have qualified, because I suspect had they played Algeria in qualifying as Libya did, they might not have won that. They might not have reached this tournament. Just having the stadiums means that they're here and they're in the tournament. I was talking to a youth coach in Soweto on Saturday morning, and he was saying in terms of self-esteem, in terms of just how South Africans view themselves, that they sort of think that the world has a very negative image of them, that the sort of hangover from apartheid is still there, which I guess is true up to a point. So he thinks the World Cup helped lift that. It helped sort of open people's eyes to the fact that South Africa is somewhere where you can do business, where you can invest. So they're the positives. Is there still poverty here? Of course there still is. Is there crushing poverty? Yes. Is there massive disorganisation and corruption in football? Yes. Is the level of South African national team any better than it was 2 or 3 years ago? No, it's still awful. So it depends which strand you want to read, but some things have developed, some things haven't moved on at all.
Right. Is the coffee still bad? Is that still awful, Jonathan?
To be honest, it's been a lot better. Right. I think maybe I've just become more discerning of which cafes to go into. But right. Also, you know, I brought my own cafeteria with me. I bought a kilo of Tesco's Finest. And so, you know, that covers the shortfalls. That's less of a problem now than it has been in the past for me, certainly.
Right. What's been your standout moment so far?
I thought the foul by the Ethiopian goalkeeper, Jamal Tesor, was magnificent. That's a foul that lived with me for a long time. That was great. Ethiopia generally, I thought, I mean, you know, I'm being slightly flippant there, but Ethiopia generally, I thought, were much better than I was expecting.
Right.
They play with a great vibrancy. Their fans are magnificent. Huge numbers of them there, you know, in the context of the tournament. Lots of them waving pictures of Haile Selassie. And you know, they really made that game against Zambia a big event. So they were great. Best game was probably Ghana v DR Congo, 2-2 draw. Again, DR Congo, one of the minnows, one of the sides we didn't particularly expect to do well, playing way above themselves. So I mean, I think that's sort of the general theme we've seen over the last 10 years in African football, that maybe the top sides aren't quite as good as they were. But the sides, so 10 down to 30 or 40 in the African rankings, they've really got a lot better. And that's why the tournaments are open these days. The top teams have fallen, everybody else has improved. And so the pyramid's maybe got lower, but it's got broader.
Right. Ivory Coast opening up with a 2-1 win over Togo. Ghana taking on Mali today. Attendances, a man with a rude French posting name says, why are the stadiums so empty? Are the tickets really expensive in the Ivory Coast-Togo game? It seemed to be in front of 3 men and a dog.
Yeah, I mean, people say it's every African Cup of Nations. It's just a fact. African Cup of Nations don't get big attendances. But the whole, I mean, I think a year ago in Equatorial Guinea, ticket pricing was a big issue. I don't think that's a problem here. I think it's just, I mean, if you think of the Euros, how many Poles and Ukrainians went to those games? Not huge numbers, a lot of travelling support. Travelling support in Africa is much harder, partly because of the cost, partly because people just don't have the money, partly because of the infrastructure. So you're not going to get 20,000 people from Ivory Coast suddenly turning up in Rustenburg, Ivory Coast v Togo. So that's one issue, but I mean, Mark Gleeson, who's sort of the great doyen of African football journalism, he always says, actually, the culture of going to a game is not as embedded as it is in Europe. That Didier Drogba might be playing 5 miles down the road, but if you're used to watching him on telly, if you're used to watching the Premier League and the Champions League, which is hugely popular here, if you're used to watching them in bars or getting your mates around having a few beers watching on TV, you still do that. There's nothing to kind of, you don't sort of think, oh, he's here, we've got to watch him. That culture is just not part of the African football watching culture.
Jonathan Wilson in South Africa.
He had a T-bone steak at a game yesterday, which apparently cost $3.50.
That's very good, yeah, isn't it?
But he didn't say what animal it came
right.
from.
Right. Yeah, that's a fair point, isn't it?
It doesn't matter. It's nice.
The FA Cup. Lots more where that came from. We did mention one or two fixtures earlier. But I tell you what, there's all sorts of other interesting things, isn't there? One or two opportunities for a little bit of magic of the cup.
Brentford-Chelsea. That is magical.
Brentford-Chelsea.
Could be magical.
Could be, couldn't it? Do you think? Yeah.
I mean, if Brentford were to win somehow in the parallel universe, it'd be an unbelievable story.
All right.
For all sorts of reasons. I mean, they are sort of almost neighbours. Brentford, I think, haven't played them in a competitive game in nearly 60 years.
Yeah.
And it'd be yet another big Chelsea defeat. So I don't think it'll happen.
Right.
But, you know, you want to talk fairy tales, etc.
They're doing very well under Uwe Rosberg, aren't they?
They are doing well, although they haven't won any of the last two games. Ah. They've drawn against Leyton Orient and lost at home to Tranmere last week, which really put a bit of a dent into their promotion run. But they're still very much in with the shout.
Right.
And Uwe Rosberg has been getting a lot of attention. There was talk of him being in the mix for the Barnsley job.
Oh.
And he certainly was interviewed for the Copenhagen job before the start of the season. And
would be a big feather in his cap if he could beat Chelsea. Go on. What do you think?
Be amazing. I don't think it'll happen. I don't think it'll happen. I think Chelsea will take this one really, really seriously, especially after getting knocked out in the League Cup. I think he'll play a very, very strong team. And I think also the team will realise, maybe unlike the League Cup, which I don't think that most of the players care that much about, that this is the last chance to do anything of note this season.
Non-league Luton, who only beat Wolves and got their manager canned last time out, are going to be taking on Norwich. In other giant-killing news, you've got Macclesfield taking on Wigan. What do you think, Barry? Upsets?
Possibly. I mean, Wigan are no great shakes, and Macclesfield have home advantage, and you'd sort of give Luton a chance if they were at home, but they're not.
They're at Norwich, aren't they? Yeah.
It's kind of not a very inspiring draw, in my opinion.
What about Leeds?
Although it looks better now. I remember when it was being made, it was just like, ugh.
Right.
It's a terrible draw, but it doesn't look quite as bad now. There's some interesting ties, and needless to say, Man U, Fulham is the one that's going to be on TV because Man U get higher viewing figures, and that's what it's all about in TV land. But I can't help but think there are more interesting fixtures there.
What would you pull out of that draw, Jacob, as a more interesting fixture? Would it be Oldham Liverpool? Hey, Liverpool won that 5-1 at Anfield last season.
Yeah.
And this time around, they only struggled past Mansfield. And, of course, Oldham, with Jose Baxter, former Everton player.
Mm.
Hey.
No, you would expect Liverpool to win that, the way they're playing at the moment, wouldn't you? Suarez and Sturridge, they take it seriously then.
You're not very happy about this draw either, are you? Do you like Leeds Spurs?
Leeds Spurs.
Which one are you going to watch?
I'll probably watch both then.
Okay.
They're not on at the same time.
Ah, that's good.
Yeah.
Right. And can they continue their giant killing antics from the League Cup? Where they knocked out Everton.
They knocked out Everton, didn't they? Yeah. Then they got stuffed by Chelsea.
If
Spurs take it seriously, then again you would expect them to take that game quite comfortably.
We're on fire for the fourth round of the FA Cup. Rafa?
No, but generally speaking, my sense is that the cup competitions have become more important.
And, the League Cup has, yeah.
Well, both. And attract more attention. I think the reason for that might be because English dominance in the Champions League has waned.
Interesting.
And you have less sort of glitzy trophies to compete for.
I think that historically speaking, FA Cup is a lot less important than it used to be, but it's perhaps not quite as less important as it was a couple of years ago.
I know
when
what
United
you mean.
Didn't bother taking part.
Yeah, you're probably right.
Yeah, Bolton Everton.
You'll get into trouble for that.
Will I?
Yeah, with Man United fans.
Oh right.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, because they were asked to not take part, weren't they? It wasn't their decision.
I didn't say it was their fault. They didn't take part.
You said
they didn't bother. Oops. All right then. Bolton Everton. If you had to pick a team to win the cup this year, let me throw this one out there. Who would it be? Because it's going to be someone with short odds.
Well, for choice or
who would you put money on?
Who wants?
No, who would you put money on? Like an outsider for the cup, you might get long odds on.
Well, you know, I mean, you would look at the Manchester clubs as the best teams in
but
the
you're not
going to
get good odds on them.
As good odds,
yeah.
Spurs, maybe.
Really? Yeah. Okay.
He's taking it seriously. He's good at cups, isn't he? And he's taking it seriously.
Hmm? He's good at cups.
Spurs, Everton, Reading, maybe.
Right, Reading for the FA Cup, says Barry Glendinning.
Well, not quite.
You regret that, man?
No, I don't regret it. Yeah. I just think they seem to be hitting form. They're enjoying quite a lot of luck.
Right.
And they're two things you need to win the FA Cup.
That's very true. Very true. That's all, though, for our FA Cup roundup. You know what? We're gonna do the fourth round in full on Monday when they've gone ahead and played the games. And then we'll have something to talk about. Super. Anything else you want to add, Rafa, Jacob, Barry?
Well, we've no Sid today, but there are a few interesting stories coming out of Spain. Well, I saw earlier, apparently Iker Casillas has broken a hand and will miss both legs of their last 16 game against Manchester United. And yep. Rafa was telling us something earlier as well.
Yeah.
Well, Marca was reporting that apparently there has been an ultimatum set by both Casillas and Ramos that if José Mourinho was still in charge, they would be off next season.
If only there was a handy Euro roundup available for people to catch up on those stories and others on the Guardian's website, available from midnight on Thursday. Anyway, that's it for today's Football Weekly Extra. So many, many thanks, Rafa, for making it in. Jacob, you yourself, you're not with us for a bit, I believe, after this. Is that right?
Got some time off.
Mm. All right. Barry, are you back on Monday?
I don't know.
All right, okay. Hey, it's a surprise. Listeners, tune in. See what hand destiny deals here. Many thanks, producer Ben. Have a super weekend, everybody. Enjoy the cups, and bye for now.